Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. So today I thought I'd show you a little bit more of the back-end functionality when you have a Squarespace website, site and account. So here you can see we've got the main pages. These are the ones that you can see linked up top. We've got these unlinked pages. So these are mostly the photo pages. So these are pages that you might link to, but you don't necessarily want people to click directly to. But then you've also got down here custom code. So if you want to upload a code file, you can do that. If you want to inject code into specific sections like footers and headers and so forth, you can do that. It does, of course, carry a warning that if you put custom code in, it may not necessarily work. But, well, if you're writing custom code, you probably know how to bug fix as well. You've got options for specific pages like checkout pages and 404 error messages, whatever you want those to look like. And then also marketing tools. So you can have a little announce bar. So if you turn it on, there's an announcement bar appears at the top of the site. If you really want to, you can have a pop-up. There you go, just like that. And also, although I can't show you specifically because this is on PC, you can also have a mobile information bar, which will show key details of the site to someone who's using a mobile device. So all the quality of life upgrades and customizable on Squarespace.
So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenafel. You can get a free trial. And once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show.
So a while back, I covered the Washington Naval Treaty, what led up to it, negotiations that went into it, and the outcomes in terms of the various treaty restrictions. So I thought today we'd do a quick rundown of the London Naval Treaty, or more accurately, the first London Naval Treaty of 1930, and see what changed compared to the Washington Treaty. So a quick bit of background. There had been attempts to further naval disarmament. So there'd been a conference in Geneva in 1928, for example. This hadn't really worked. But by 1929, 1930, not only was the world's economy taking a little bit of a downturn, but also the limitations that had been imposed on building certain kinds of ships in the Washington Naval Treaty were due to expire relatively soon. And so nations were looking for a little bit of certainty, because if the battleship building holiday was going to expire, then, well, by 1930, they needed to start looking at designing whatever it was that they were going to build when that limitation expired. And if they could agree to extend the building holiday, well, again, they needed to know soon so they didn't waste money. Plus, a bunch of loopholes and other things had cropped up in the 1920s that some powers were fairly keen to close down. There were also some vague efforts that went into the discussions to actually impose still further limits on the construction of capital ships, not just in terms of extending the building holiday, but also in terms of downrating them in both tonnage and armament. But those kinds of things are more suited for a more in-depth video looking at the political background and the negotiations behind all the naval treaties, as opposed to just briefly going over what finally ended up being the changes imposed. So with that, let's go over said changes. Part 1, Article 1, essentially was, okay, we're going to extend the battleship building holiday to 1936. So it was a 5-year extension, except, of course, if you accidentally lost a ship or it was destroyed in a explosion or something like that, you were allowed to replace things. And France and Italy, which had been allowed to build new capital ships in 1927 and 1929, which they hadn't done, were still allowed to essentially carry those provisions forward. So if they wanted to build some capital ships in the first half of the 1930s, they legally could. Part 1, Article 2 involved the disposal of a number of additional capital ships. Now, the original Washington Treaty had called for about 525,000 tons of capital ships for the Royal Navy and the US Navy, and just over 300,000 tons for the Japanese. But because everybody's ships had different tonnages, that meant some navies had considerably more ships than others. But now, rather than go for a 553 ratio by tonnage, they were actually going to go for a 553 ratio by actual capital ships. And that meant that some ships had to go. So the US had to lose Florida, Utah, and either Arkansas or Wyoming, so 3 ships. The British had to lose the entire Iron Duke class plus Tiger, so 5 ships. and the Japanese had to lose Hiei, which would leave everybody with 15 ships for the US, 15 ships for the UK, and 9 ships for the Japanese, which, if you divide through by 3, is a very nice 5-5-3 ratio. Realistically, this clause slightly favoured the British, because on the one hand, yes, they were losing the most ships. They were losing 5 ships compared to the 3 from the Americans and 1 from the Japanese, but they were all 13.5-inch armed ships, so it left the entire British fleet armed with a 15-inch gun, except for Nelson and Rodney, which had 16-inch, whereas the US, retaining either Arkansas or Wyoming, had 12-inch guns, 14-inch guns, and 16-inch guns in the fleet. The Japanese had 14 and 16-inch guns, and of course, taking out one of the Congo-class left them with just 3 battlecruisers, the same number as the British. And everybody was given a little bit of time. They could scrap these in sequence, and of course, thanks to the provisions of the Washington Treaty, if they turned them into training ships or otherwise non-frontline capital ships, they could keep the hulls around. And of course, that is what happened with Utah, Wyoming, Hiei, and Iron Duke. And there was a clause in the treaty in this section allowing for the retention of most of those ships for training purposes. Article 3 was essentially the aircraft carrier loophole closing article. So that replaced the definition in the Washington Treaty, which included that an aircraft carrier was a vessel above 10,000 tons, to simply be an aircraft carrier is any surface vessel of war, whatever its displacement, designed for the specific and exclusive purpose of carrying aircraft and constructed so that aircraft can be launched therefrom and landed thereon, which was basically at Nomura Ruggiero's Japan clause. Interestingly, though, it says in Section 2 of Article 3, the fitting of a landing on or flying off platform or deck on a capital ship, cruiser, or destroyer, provided such vessel was not designed or adapted exclusively as an aircraft carrier, shall not cause any vessel so fitted to be charged against or classified in the category of aircraft carriers. So that's why the cruiser carrier and the battle carrier then see a whole bunch of design studies done, because essentially what this clause is saying is, as long as the thing can still fight a half-decent surface action and is primarily a surface ship, you can actually have a flight deck on it as a secondary function, and it's not an aircraft carrier. It would count against your cruiser or battleship categories. Interestingly, though, it does say that no capital ship in existence on the 1st of April 1930, so the stuff they've already got, shall be fitted with a landing on platform or deck, so no retrofitting your existing capital ships into battle carriers. Article 4 covers more minutiae about carriers, so it says no aircraft carrier of 10,000 tons or less displacement mounting a gun above 6.1 inches shall be acquired by or constructed for any of the high contracting parties. So this meant that if you were going to build aircraft carriers under 10,000 tons, the biggest gun you could give it was a 6.1 inch. And Article 2 basically says, yeah, also you can't build one of those things for somebody else. Article 5, just for the case of clarification, because of course you could on its own read Article 4 is to say, well, okay, if I remember over 10,000 tons on my carrier, I can build it with whatever caliber gun I want. It says, no, you're still limited by what the Washington Treaty says, which was essentially you can have any number of up to 6-inch guns on your carrier or less, and any number of 5-inch or less anti-aircraft guns. But if you're going to have more than 6 but less than 8-inch guns, i.e. up to 8-inch gun caliber, then anything that's bigger than 6 inches but less than 8 inches, you can only have a limited number of, and you can't have anything above 8 inches. And there's a little bit of just a clear up there as well, because in Article 5 it says, well, yeah, in the previous articles we said 6 inches or 152 mil, but okay, yeah, we're allowing 6.1 inch or 155 mil for those of you who are working in metric. Article 6 just essentially clarifies what standard displacement means, what the standard displacement of a submarine is, and which ton we're going to be using. Article 7 is the submarine loophole closing article, because that starts off with no submarine of the standard displacement which exceeds 2,000 tons or 2,032 metric tons, or with a gun above 5.1 inch in caliber, that's 130 mil, shall be acquired by or constructed for any of the high contracting parties. So no more cruiser submarines for you. However, there was an exception to this, which was the second part of Article 7, which was that you were allowed to either retain, i.e. if you've already got them, you can keep them, build, if you haven't got them, you could build them, or acquire, buy them from someone else, a maximum of 3 submarines of up to 2,800 tons, and those submarines could carry a gun of up to 6.1 inches in calibre. So something like, say, X-1 would be allowed under this loophole. And there's a little exception carved out, which basically says the French can keep Surcouf. Part 3 of Article 7 says, by the way, if you do have a submarine that's under 2,000 tons and has a gun above 5.1 inch calibre already, yeah, you can keep that. So subs that might have a 6-inch deck gun for whatever reason, or if any of the M-class were still around with their 12-inch gun, they would have been allowed under this categorization. But no further ones could be built. Article 8 categorizes ships that you can build unlimited numbers of because they aren't subject to any kind of limitation, and these fall into three categories. Firstly, anything that is 600 ton standard displacement or less, you can build however much you want of, and they can be armed however you like. Then, naval vessels between 600 and 2,000 tons displacement were unlimited, providing that they had no gun larger than 6.1 inches, and no more than four guns were bigger than 3 inches. They weren't allowed to be designed or fitted to launch torpedoes, and they weren't allowed to be faster than 20 knots. This specification was actually built almost entirely around the Bougainville class, which the French were building at the time. But essentially, it meant that you could build small patrol craft and or sloops, that kind of stuff, in theoretically unlimited numbers. And finally, you could build naval vessels as long as they were used on fleet duties, i.e. supply ships, or troop transports, or as the clause says, basically some other way other than as fighting ships. So not a frontline warship, an auxiliary. But if you were going to build such things, then you couldn't have a gun above 6.1 inches again. You couldn't have more than four guns above 3 inches. You couldn't have torpedoes. You couldn't go faster than 20 knots. And then they put a bunch of additional things onto this because, of course, these ships are theoretically tonnage unlimited, so you can immediately see the potential for rules abuse. You weren't allowed to put armor plate on them. You weren't allowed to put mines on them. You weren't allowed to put any kind of flight deck to recover aircraft on them. So things like arrestor cables and so forth. You couldn't have more than one aircraft launching apparatus on the center line, or two if you were launching them from the broadside. So basically no more than one catapult dead ahead or one on each side. And if you were going to put a catapult on this ship, then you couldn't have more than three aircraft on it. So that was essentially allowing you to have a scout aircraft or two, but nothing more. Article 9 basically says just see Annex 1 for the replacement rules for cruisers. Article 10 says that if you do lay down these unlimited vessels, or any number of these unlimited vessels, you do actually have to tell everyone else that you're doing so, with all the relevant specs, you know, what it is, how much it displaces, what its dimensions are, etc., etc. Basically allowing everyone to check that you're telling the truth, assuming that you are telling the truth about their specs as well. Article 11 is just a point to an annex to tell you what the disposal rules and replacement rules are for capital ships. Article 12 has four separate sections. The first section says that, well, there's a list in Annex 3 which shows various special vessels that don't count towards tonnage limitations, despite technically meeting one or more of the criteria that would otherwise put them in that specification. And, well, Annex 3 lists all these so-called special vessels, and there's all sorts of things. There's an Italian seaplane carrier, there's the monitors Erebus, Terror, and Marshal Soult in the British category, there's a handful of sloops, some dispatch vessels, mine layers. The French have a seaplane carrier on there as well. There's various tenders for destroyers and submarines, gunboats. And the Japanese even have a bunch of their old armored cruisers on there, the Asama, Yakumo, Izumo, Iwate, and Kasuga. The next section says, however, if you want to replace those vessels, then they will get charged against your regular tonnage limitations. But then there's a couple of exceptions even to that, which are the next two bits of Article 12. The Japanese are allowed to replace two mine layers as long and still keep them as outside the tonnage limits, as long as they're not more than 20 knots and 5,000 tons. And the old armored cruisers that the Japanese still retain could be kept for the minute, but once the Kuma class were replaced by new vessels, then the Kuma class would be used as training ships and those old armored cruisers would be scrapped. And then Article 13 says essentially that, well, if you're using anything at this point as a training establishment or a hulk, i.e. it's an old ship that can't really move under its own power anymore, then, well, you can keep that and we won't count it. Now, those are all of the articles that the original five signatories agreed to. So Japan, UK, US, France, and Italy. Annex 1 then tells you how old a ship needs to be before it can be replaced. Annex 2 has plenty of details on how you actually dispose of vessels, i.e. what you need to do to have a vessel counted as scrapped, what you need to do to convert it to a hulk, what you need to do to turn it into a target, what you need to do if you want to retain the vessel for an experimental use, and what you need to do if you want to turn the vessel into a training ship. Annex 3 is that list of special vessels we mentioned earlier. And then we come on to Part 3, and Part 3 was only agreed between the US, Britain, and Japan. So Italy and France refused to sign up to the next few sets of restrictions. So essentially this covers cruisers and destroyers. So Article 14 basically is those three nations saying, yep, we agree that these limitations shall apply. And then Article 15 defines a cruiser as something that's not a capital ship, but exceeds 1,850 tons standard displacement or has a gun above 5.1 inch in caliber. And since the Washington Treaty set the threshold for a capital ship at 10,000 tons, this is essentially saying a cruiser is a vessel that exceeds 1,850 tons, but is 10,000 tons or less. Or if the ship is under 10,000 tons and has a gun above 5.1 inches, period, it's also a cruiser. So you could make a 1,500-ton ship with a 6-inch gun, and despite the fact that by tonnage that would be a destroyer, because it's got that 6-inch gun, it would become a cruiser. And then the cruiser, having now defined what it is divided into two subcategories, which is a cruiser carrying a gun that's bigger than 6.1 inches, which we'd call a heavy cruiser, and a gun that's not carrying a gun that's bigger than 6.1 inches, so what we call a light cruiser. Article 15 also defines a destroyer as essentially a ship that doesn't exceed 1,850 tons and doesn't have a gun bigger than 5.1 inches. So this was designed to curb the construction of super destroyers. The Japanese agreed to it, even though they just about started in on this. The French, however, who started already with their contre-torpilleurs being quite large vessels, obviously hadn't signed up to this. So technically speaking, although the contre-torpilleurs of the 1930s break the London Naval Treaty terms, the French had basically said, now we're not agreeing to this section anyway. So now we've got essentially heavy cruiser, light cruiser, and destroyer categories. They then agreed a number of tonnage restrictions overall for each nation. So everyone was allowed 52,700 tons of submarines. The British and the Americans were given 150,000 tons of destroyers. The Japanese were given 105,500 tons. But then when it comes to heavy and light cruisers, things are a little bit different. So for the US, they were allowed up to 180,000 tons of heavy cruisers, but only 143,500 tons of light cruisers. With the British, things were flipped on their head. They were only allowed 146,800 tons of heavy cruisers, but they were allowed 192,200 tons of light cruisers. And the Japanese were allowed 108,400 tons of heavy cruisers and 100,450 tons of light cruisers. And if those seem like really weirdly specific numbers, that's essentially because they were taking into account the existing cruiser tonnages, and then assuming that anything above that would be a standard 10,000-ton cruiser. And the reason for this was essentially the British wanted more small cruisers to go and patrol their massive empire, whereas the other two nations were a bit more concerned about big heavy cruisers for battle fleet escort in the Pacific, and so these tonnages were finally adjusted. If they had any vessels that would put them above this limit, they had to dispose of them, and more specifically, in terms of heavy cruisers, they're actually limited both by overall tonnage, but also by number of ships. So the US was allowed 18 heavy cruisers, the British were allowed 15, and the Japanese 12. Now that's quite interesting, because of course 180,000 divided by 18, it dissolves into a nice neat 10,000 tons. So you could have 18 10,000-ton heavy cruisers if you were American. But for the British, 15 10,000-ton heavy cruisers would put you a little bit over your limit. So you could have 14 10,000-ton cruisers, and then somehow you'd have to fit an 8-inch cruiser into 6,800 tons if you wanted to have your 15 ships, which in part explains things like the York class later on in the 1930s. The Japanese really caught the short end of the stick because, well, they're allowed 12 heavy cruisers, but they don't even have 11 10,000-ton ships worth of displacement allowed. But this made allocation for the fact the Furutakas and the Albers existed, which had fallen into the heavy cruiser category now, but were significantly under 10,000 tons. Section 4 of Article 16 further went into destroyer tonnage and basically said 16% of your total destroyer tonnage could be up to 1,850 tons, but the rest of it had to be just 1,500 tons or less. And if you already had over that, then fine, you could keep your existing heavy destroyers, but you couldn't build any further destroyers above 1,500 tons until you gradually aged out your existing, if you like, heavy destroyers. And stop everyone making fleets of cruiser carriers. No more than 25% of your cruiser tonnage could have a landing on platform or a flight deck for aircraft. It also said your big submarines, like Surcouf and X-1, counted towards your overall submarine tonnage. Article 17 is quite interesting because it says a transfer not exceeding 10% of the allowed total tonnage of the category or subcategory into which the transfer is to be made shall be permitted between cruisers of subcategory B, and that is light cruisers, and destroyers. So if you wanted slightly more destroyers or slightly more cruisers, you could actually transfer a certain amount of your tonnage over one way or the other. Article 18 was an exemption the US carved out for itself, which was quite nifty, which said that by 1935, they anticipated having 15 cruisers with an overall tonnage of 150,000 tons in the heavy cruiser category. But they obviously at that point would be left with three possible additional heavy cruisers to build, and they left themselves two options. The second option was that if they chose to build those remaining three heavy cruisers, then they gave undertakings that those three ships wouldn't be complete before 1936, 1937, and 1938. Or if they chose not to build them, then they could substitute each of those ships with 15,166 tons of light cruiser. Now, note that's not giving them the ability to build a just over 15,000-ton light cruiser. It's just 15,166 tons of light cruiser. So they're essentially trading off 10,000 tons for 15,166 tons. So essentially they're saying if we don't build a heavy cruiser, we want just a bit more than 50% additional tonnage in our light cruiser category on top of the tonnage we didn't build, which is, you know, that's a nice deal if you want those kinds of cruisers. Now, interestingly enough, if you don't build those three heavy cruisers, so that's a total of 45,498 tons, and you divide through by six, that gives you 7,583 tons, which would be a rather nice displacement for, say, a large destroyer leader armed with a lot of 5-inch guns. I mean, the Atlantic class did actually end up coming out even slightly below that, but you can kind of see what they were aiming at as keeping their options open there. Article 19 says that essentially you're not allowed to bulk build modern cruisers now and say, oh yeah, well, you know, we're building these to replace ships that are going to become overage and need replacement 5-6 years down the line. You have to, roughly speaking, keep building new ships to fill up tonnage that is only just coming up for replacement. And all of that is subject to you can only replace ships after they're so old in the various appendixes, which we skipped over. However, there were a few exceptions to that. So the Hawkins-class cruisers Frobisher and Effingham were allowed to be disposed of a little bit early, and of course they could then be replaced early. The Japanese had a ship called the Tama, which they were allowed to replace with new construction as well. Recognizing that the Japanese had a number of small destroyers that weren't going to age out for quite a while, but by the late 30s would be fairly combat incapable in terms of frontline units, they were allowed to lay down 5,200 tons of additional destroyers to replace destroyers that might become overage in 38 and 39, but they're allowed to do that early, essentially saying, yeah, you kind of have to keep those small destroyers around for a while, but we appreciate they're not really frontline combatants at that point. And they could also do the same thing with some of their subs. Article 21 is actually a mini escalator clause for cruisers and destroyers that essentially says, look, if someone else outside of us three countries signing this builds a bunch of cruisers or destroyers that manifestly threaten one of us, and that power decides, you know what, I need to build more cruisers, more destroyers, or bigger cruisers, bigger destroyers to counter that, then you're allowed to, but you have to tell the other two powers basically say, look, this is what I want to build that's in excess of the treaty, and this is the category it's going to fall under, and then everyone will adjust their tonnage in that category to compensate by whatever ratio is necessary, so everyone gets the increase. Article 22 is just outlining some of the details around how merchant ships need to act in terms of being stopped and searched. Part 5, which starts with Article 23, says that the treaty runs till the end of 1936, except for the bit that we just mentioned about international law with regards to merchant ships, which just continues onwards. And the rules related to aircraft carriers will stay in force for as long as the Washington Treaty stays in force. And it also commits them to meeting in 1935 to try and replace the existing treaties with a new treaty, which of course will become the Second London Naval Treaty. And the rest of the articles in the London Naval Treaty are just about how everybody's going to ratify it and everybody's going to get on and sing songs and hug each other and be friends and all of that kind of stuff. So that's a quick rundown of the relevant articles of the London Naval Treaty and how they affected warship design, who'd signed up to what, and exactly what they could and couldn't do. And hopefully that's been a useful, handy little guide if you don't want to read the wall of text that is the First London Naval Treaty. Let me know if you want me to cover the Second London Naval Treaty at some point.